Glenda Glees, Marco Gerber, and Grant Moninger, and we are sponsored by The Hollywood Reporter. Our publicists are Weissman Markowitz Communications, Sherry Warner, and Leonard Morpurgo. Our in-house producer is Debbie Patton, and the guy that makes all our media for us is Dennis Welsh. Tonight we have a special guest. Our guest is Professor Nicholas Kull. He's a professor of public diplomacy. It's not going to sound like that's to do much with movies, but it does, believe me. A professor of public diplomacy in USC at the Annenberg School. He has been at a number of very prestigious universities, Leeds, Princeton, University of Berkeley. He directed the American Studies, the Center for American Studies in Leicester. His specialty is really culture of information, news, and propaganda in foreign policy. He's the author of Cold War and U.S. Information Agency, American Propaganda and Public Diplomacy, Propaganda and Mass Persuasion, an historical encyclopedia. This is going to be amazing. And he's just finished a book. Well, he's done a book called Projecting Empire, Imperialism in Popular Culture, and he's followed it up with a similar title book on science fiction, which is how he happens to be here. When I mentioned to a mutual friend of mine at USC that I wanted to show this film, he said, well, I've got the guy who actually has done all the research and has written extensively about the movie. So it's not on him. Okay. Well, let me tell you why we're here. Does anyone recognize this magazine? This is a 1961 magazine. I don't know where I got this ratty thing. You can't even really read it. It's so old and so broken. But this has a still in it from Just Imagine, which I saw as a kid. And as an art director, I spent my whole life wondering why I can't see this movie until I finally asked. And it turns out that they were able to get a copy of the Cinematheque. It amazed me. So this is a rare treat. But first, since this is in the Art Directors Film Society, I want to say a few words about the art director who designed this film. While every screening is certainly about paying tribute to the artist, this is not a biographical show. We do that sort of thing at a banquet. It's much more about the art than the artist. And like all great artists, the designer of this picture, and when I say designer, what I mean is art director, because this goes back to the days when there were no production designers. The boss of the art department was called art director, and you will see on the reel how much work this guy did. But anyway, like all great artists, Stephen Husson's work will speak for itself. We've tried to do a different reel than we usually do, for those of you who've been here before. We generally do sort of one of those precious images, TCM kind of reels with a lot of cuts. This time we've tried doing a scene from each movie, a scene that is really interesting and fun in itself, but that really shows off the art direction. And I think you will find, you really shouldn't think while you're watching movies, right? But I gotta tell you, when you're watching this, remember that everything on this reel is all created. None of it's on location. Some of it's outside, but everything is built. Everything you see is from the mind of this man. Nothing's found, it's not a location picture. So, you know, a romance in a hayfield, a dramatic scene on the deck of a skyscraper. It's all believable, it's all dramatically sound, but it all comes from the mind of the designer. So I think that's all I really wanted to say about this. Yes, we'll run Mr. Gusson's clip, and then we'll have an interesting surprise for you. So this extra special guest we have is a guy who actually knew Stephen Gusson. Stephen? Where are you? Okay, you're supposed to walk up here.
Story about my grandfather. He passed away in 1973, and I was 20 years old at the time. So I have some first background information on him, but so much of what I remember about my grandfather came from my mom, who was like our family historian, and she would write and chronicle everything. So I thought about, when I came here tonight, just a quick story about him. I think the neatest thing that my mom said was that my grandfather was born in 1889 in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He went to the University of Michigan to study architecture. When he graduated, much to my grandmother's chagrin, he dragged her to Detroit, and he started an architectural practice. back in 1919, and I wish I'm still working on the details, but my grandfather was vacationing in Hollywood, and a friend of his said, if you're going to go to Hollywood, you need to meet a friend of mine. And that turned out to be Louis Selznick. And I'm sure everybody knows who that is. He's truly one of the pioneers of early film. So my grandfather went out and paid $150 for a brand new suit. And he tells a story. The office in the building was off of what is now Gower. And it was an old dirt road, and my grandfather climbed up to the fourth floor. And Louis Selznick was at a production meeting with some folks that were talking about a movie. So the door was open, and my grandfather could listen to everything. So two things about him, a lot of things I remember, but first of all, he whistled incessantly. He always whistled. Whether he was cooking or driving or painting, he whistled. And then he was an incredible doodler. He always took a scratch pad with him, a steno pad, and he was always drawing something. So Louis Selznick was in this meeting, and my grandfather's listening to all this, and naturally he starts to doodle. He does all this. So the meeting's over. Louis Selznick comes out. You know, they meet each other, get acquainted, and they go into his office, and they get to know each other. So halfway through it, Louis looks down and goes, well, what's that? And my grandfather says, nothing. It's just my idea of what the set could look like of the movie you were just talking about. So Louis Selznick, he offered my grandfather a job on the spot. And my grandfather took the job on the spot. And I don't know how he did this, but my grandmother was ill at the time. She had tuberculosis. So he shipped her out on the train. Somehow, without the internet, without phones, he closed down his architectural practice, sold his house, and never went back to Michigan, and he was in Hollywood to stay. So he worked for Louis Selznick for probably, I think, 3 years. And then he went over to Columbia Pictures at the time, and Columbia only had two assets back then. It was Frank Capra and Mary Pickford. And my grandfather spent his whole career at Columbia, was nominated for 5 Academy Awards. Obviously won. So when I was going through, my mom chronicled like crazy, and so early on in Hollywood, as these notes my mom said, when sets were designed, they were done two-dimensional. They used to take these gigantic pieces of canvas and put them on a wall, and the sets would be painted, right? And I think because my grandfather was an architect, he was one of the first, I'm sorry, in the mirror, he was one of the first that actually thought three-dimensionally. So the set for Lost Horizon was actually built in an old aircraft hangar in Hollywood that was 3 city blocks square. It cost $100,000, and we still have a copy of a letter that my grandfather wrote. He was convinced he was going to get fired because it cost so much money to build that set. So I just have great memories of him. Very talented, tremendous painter, tremendous drawer. Our family probably has 1,000 color pictures and charcoal sketches and all of that. But I think the neatest thing is he went to Hollywood and then never went back. And that was sort of the beginning of his career.
They made that film, and then in 1927, the Germans made Metropolis. naturally Hollywood wanted to make a musical comedy. So what you got now is you've got, and they really spared no expense on it. I've got some figures later if I can read you, actually directly from the guy who designed the miniatures. I can read you some, just talking about how much it costs and how hard it was to do. But Hollywood really gave the art department and the visual effects department pretty much a blank check. However, at the same time, the rest of this movie is pretty much like a vaudeville show. It was done, it was music, music was written, it was choreographed, and the characters, they're very winning, you know, they're very charming. But this is before Busby Berkeley. This is more like vaudeville. And what I'm really trying to say to you is, this is a first attempt. This is the first time Hollywood tried to make this kind of movie. And they really didn't try again until, when did they try again? You know what I mean? When did they do another big musical comedy? I mean, the only thing I can think of, and this is a terrible thing to bring up, would be The Apple. That some of you, I'm sure, are groaning. But you will see in this film, you will see some really interesting stuff, some jokes that seem very good. There's what we now today would call an LGBT character in the movie, strangely enough. There is a whole thing about Henry Ford and his anti-Semitism. There's the attitude toward women is a little kind of on the caveman level. But I think, you know, if you can get into it, I think you will really enjoy it. If I saw this yesterday, it's the first time on a big screen. And it's really kind of amazing and fun. So I hope you enjoy it. And afterwards, Professor Cull, who has really looked into it, and I will have a talk. And you're all invited to stick around. Thank you. Professor Cull. Please come up. Oh, there he is. Our plan is to talk a few minutes about this movie while it's still fresh in your mind. And then we have another reel of to fit this into sort of the continuum of futuristic science fiction films. So that'll be an interesting thing to see. But first, we really should. Shall we talk a little bit about this?
Yep.
This is featured in your book. So tell us, well, tell us a little bit about the book and then about why in particular this movie is of such interest to you, if you would.
First of all, John, I wanted to say thanks so much for arranging this. And in having studied the film, I never thought that I would be standing outside a movie theater with a marquee reading Just Imagine and be able to see it on the big screen. And I've seen it many times in the DVD print that's available of it. And it makes such a difference to see it on the big screen. So much more detail is visible in this print. So thank you very much for making this possible, and thanks to the Guild and the Cinematheque for putting this on. It's just for me, it's something I never thought I'd have the opportunity to do.
Well, no one was ever more doubtful than me. The lesson is, you should ask for things, guys. I've wanted to see this film for many years, and finally I just said, let's try it. I never thought a print would exist. The projectionist checked into it. He says this print is from the 70s, which kind of explains why it looks the way it does. Because, you know, black and white film going all the way back to silent days, fabulous film, very detailed, and superior to color film in some ways. And, of course, that's why the soundtrack is so terrible, because it's probably a contact print off of a beat-up print from the 19-whenever. So.
My book, which is co-written with a colleague from the United Kingdom, James Chapman, Our basic approach as historians is to look at the way that we can use film to understand the moments in which it was created. So using film as a historical text. We did this with our book on Empire, and our plan was to look at the history of the future to see how you can understand the past by looking at the shifts in the way in which the future is represented. So the book, which is called Projecting Tomorrow, it comes out in October. It's already available on Amazon for pre-order, and this is one of the major case studies. We also look at things to come, in Planet, some British science fiction from the 1950s, the Quatermass Mass series. We go through to 2001, Planet of the Apes, to a wonderful wonderful documentary film filmed in a science fiction frame called The Hellstrom Chronicle. Do you remember that? It was, if you haven't ever seen it, it's a terrific made and using them as windows on their own time was a tremendous experience, but also it was interesting to see how particular themes are reflected throughout the film and sort of throughout that series of films, and a certain number of ideas get kicked around over the sort of 50-year period we were writing about, as filmmakers, each in their own time, speculate about similar themes, particularly the changing relationship between men and women, the relationship between human beings and technology, science, and whether science is moral or not, or morally neutral. And all of these themes are present in Just Imagine. The wonderful thing about Just Imagine, to me, is that it's all being invented right up there on the screen, that nobody's quite sure where it's going. There isn't such a thing at this point as a science fiction genre, and so they're putting all these things into the film that we wouldn't now expect, like the idea of a science fiction musical, like mixing in dialect, Swedish dialect comedy, and all the stuff that makes it seem so strange. And yet behind all this, we can still see elements that we recognize, and particularly the magnificent interiors, the magnificent futurist landscape that's so well realized in the city. I think that sort of they must have run out of budget by the time they got to building Mars and sort of creating that wonderful Martian dog with the the floppiness. One of the things that I love going through some stuff that the director David Butler wrote was that as they were thinking about how they were going to create a planet, a different planet, they thought about what they'd like to do. And they suggested, wouldn't it be great if we could have six-legged horses, which is one of the things that turns up in Avatar.
Yeah.
And they said, no, we can't do anything that complicated, so let's just have the planet populated by twins. And so they used the twinning thing as a way, a cheap way of getting to a very strange idea, otherworldly idea.
You know, I know you've written a lot about government, that kind of
yes.
thing, and it's interesting in this film, each time I see it, I see how much more kind of anti-government or complaining about government. It's almost a Tea Party movie in a way.
Yeah.
You know, do you guys, do the younger people here understand about this whole thing with Prohibition, where alcohol was outlawed?
This is one of the things that dates the movie in a way, is that it really reflects the political concerns of the year 1930, where America was 10 years into Prohibition, and the Volstead Act is mentioned in the film, and when the census taker says it was a noble experiment, that this was one of the phrases that was applied to Prohibition, a noble experiment, I think by, I think it was Hoover who called it that. And in a way, that obsession of, I look at this film really as a film about Prohibition and the idea of the government overreaching itself. And as today the Tea Party worried about the government overreaching with taxation and healthcare, back then the thing they were most worried about was the government regulating people's leisure. And the idea that 50 years hence, America still might not have come to terms with Prohibition and people would still be living on the assumption that there'd be a minor tweak so that beer and white wine would become legally available, is an in-joke. But that fixation with a political issue of the year 1930 means that the film had a very short shelf life, because by 1931-32, Prohibition was repealed. It was impossible to take a drink even before Roosevelt was inaugurated as president. So what's the point of an anti-Prohibition movie after Prohibition has been repealed? It didn't even survive as a historical oddity. Because it's 1980, they're assuming that the census will be repeated every 10 years into the future. So that's why the census had just been through in 1930, so the audience would be thinking about the census and the idea of the government regulating through survey and sort of little element of what we now think of as Big Brother coming into play when in a census year, and they're projecting that into the future and realizing 1980 would also be
very happy with women, you know, not being able to choose their mates, but husbands being able to choose them. So, because in those days weren't, I'm sure not a lot of people know about this, there were a lot of eugenic experiments, actually the eugenic laws in the South, correct?
Yeah.
Do you guys know what eugenic laws are? I mean, this is really creepy stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, this was the idea of that science could...
what are eugenic laws?
That's what he's going to explain.
There were prohibitions in some places on what were called the feeble-minded reproducing. So that would be actually saying that people who had intellectual disabilities couldn't get married, couldn't have kids, and in some places chemical castration of intellectually disabled people. And it took a long time for America to get over some of these scientific ideas that had scientific authority at this time. And
later on, before the Nazis.
Sure. Well, this was all contemporaneous, and you know, in a way, one of the things that comes out of World War II is that Hitler gives racism a bad name, and it was perfectly fine at this time to have a lot of racist and genocist ideas. And I think one of the things that's a little creepy about the world of 1980 is that it's an entirely white world. That there are the only non-Caucasian. There's one, I think, Japanese-looking scientist.
Yeah, I noticed the Japanese scientist.
But other than that, it's...
There's an Irish cop.
It's Lily White, there's an Irish cop. And whatever the ethnicity, the flunky is, he's some sort of vague Eastern European... the chap who finds...
Misha Howard?
Yeah, on the...
Tall, skinny man.
Yeah, the tall, skinny guy. Do you know where he's supposed to be from?
Well, he played... Wasn't he like he was in all the Warner Brothers pictures, like Casablanca and everything? Was that the guy who was like a bartender in Casablanca? It's not a Casablanca audience, obviously.
Maybe Sasha, the bartender in Casablanca. I didn't recognize
kind of,
him.
Yeah, but he's Eastern European.
He's some vague Hollywood Eastern European.
Yeah, he sticks out because he's so interesting.
But there are no people of color.
Yeah. I have some information. Can we talk about technical things for just a minute? Because I know some people are interested in this. This movie was designed. The credits on this movie are interesting. The credit is settings, and they're credited to Gusson, who we know is an amazing art director. They're also credited to a guy named Ralph Hamers, who meant nothing to me as a designer until I looked into it. And Hamers was a visual effects supervisor or a visual effects designer that is not anywhere near well known as he should be. The one Oscar he got was for doing the miniature work in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But he was a fixture at Fox for many years, worked on a million pictures, all sorts of stuff, Yank at Oxford. You've done this research as well, right? And I have a statement. They did actually, in Cinefex magazine, which the effects people here will know about, back in the 80s, they ran a long article with him. And this is what he had to say about the picture. He said, "Just Imagine was a very interesting project that called for a miniature representation of New York City 50 years in the future. The set was a colossal affair with futuristic skyscrapers towering 250 stories into the air, 9 different lanes of traffic and levels for pedestrians, automobiles, air lanes with planes in motion. Each detail was carried out with the utmost care and precision. Model autos appeared on the highways. Canals were constructed so that ocean-going steamers could dock beneath the buildings, and all streets and skyscrapers were electrically lighted. Dirigibles were flying through the air on or moored to the buildings, and landing fields were included upon the roofs of the skyscrapers for the airplanes." And here's the statistics. The entire set measured 250 feet long, 90 feet wide, and because of its size, it was built in the Arcadia balloon hangar. Yeah. The practical operation of the set was controlled from beneath the street levels with 400 pulleys and belts, all out of sight. 2 generators and 100 sun arcs were necessary for the lighting, and together with 2 camera crews, 220 men were required for practical operation during shooting. The layout of the set started in April. We completed it by August. The total cost for that one miniature was $257,000. That's in $1930. Plus the many gray hairs that cost our technical staff.
But I don't think they use it.
That's
amazingly underused.
Well, that's the tragedy. Everyone here who works in visual effects knows you're constantly building stuff like this. It doesn't get into the movie. Gene Kuzicki, who's kind of an historian for this kind of material, is pointing out that there are stills that are relatively easy to find, and the great stills are not in the movie.
No.
You know, of the great views of that set don't wind up in the film. What are you going to do?
And in a way, part of the reputation, part of the reputation of this film came from the stills, because it really wasn't available to see from the, you know, the 50s, 60s, and most of the 70s. People knew the stills and had heard this story of a Hollywood response to Metropolis, and were really keen to see it, and were kind of underwhelmed when they actually saw the picture. Mm-hmm. And because a lot of the, exactly this reason, that the publicity stills that they set up are not reflected in the movie. Though it's wonderful to see what's going on outside, and in a way, having throwaway shots of this fantastic world happening just outside the window, which is so visible here and on the big screen print, there is something charming to that, that you can take it or leave it, and it just adds a sort of depth to what's happening. And I think it would be much less of a film without those cityscapes outside the windows and being used as backdrops.
There's another really interesting angle that I want to look into, and I know some of the other people here. There are to my eyes, are rear projection shots. For instance, when the girl runs out to the rocket ship and then it goes off, that looks like the biggest rear projection screen I've ever seen in my life, and that was 80 years ago. I'm old enough to have worked on shows where you did rear projection, because it's not a great system, it's very difficult. But the fact that in 1930 they were doing that, and of course you can tell us about this, there was a lot of legal worry.
In order to research this film, I got in touch with 20th Century Fox to see, well, what archives remain from this, and they've not only had a little bit of production, a little bit of script material, but the big files on this were the legal files, and I thought, well, what on earth legal could there be? Not just the contract material, but I found that they had to do due diligence to make sure that the special effects that they used in the film did not infringe on anybody's patent. But even more interesting than this were the legal cases that were filed after the film came out. And basically, every idiot who'd ever written a science fiction script filed suit claiming that their proprietary ideas had been infringed, such as the idea of a rocket ship going to Mars, or another planet where there were twins. And particularly, there was a writer called David Halperin who'd written a stage play that he'd once shown to a movie producer. It wasn't even a Fox producer. It was somebody from MGM, but he filed suit claiming that there must have been a collusion. And this was examined, and 20th Century Fox made its defense, and there was no case. The case was thrown out. But one thing that's interesting as you go right through the history of science fiction is that there's always a doubt as to what is general property within the genre, right, and what is somebody's specific idea. And this wouldn't be the last time that there would be big lawsuits in the science fiction genre. Harlan Ellison filed suit against James Cameron because the idea of a time-traveling robot in Terminator and won. Mm-hmm. 20th Century Fox and George Lucas sued over Battlestar Galactica, claiming that the idea of a sort of distressed future was somehow proprietary, and that case didn't go anywhere. Where does proprietary material begin and end? It's fascinating to see that idea being fought out in court as early as 1930.
I saw psychological
original source for this is a sketch in the George White Scandals of 1926. And so Busby Berkeley is part of that whole milieu. And the strangest stuff about this film really is the stuff that comes out of Broadway. The reason they were invited to make the film was because they'd done Sunnyside Up the year before with the same director, David Butler. And El Brindell, the Swedish dialect comedian, had had a role in Sunnyside Up. And they were trying to think, well, we've had this bankable hit. How many elements can we recapture from that? Let's have the same music, the same cameo star, the same director, and let's build it around a different sketch from the George White Scandals. And as far as they were concerned, they were just having a go at doing something that would be original and interesting. But I think that the Broadway is part of this, and as is vaudeville.
Backwards, actually.
It's in Caesar, too.
Yeah.
And who is the, you just mentioned, who is the one, the big clown?
El Brindell. El Brindell, he came out of vaudeville.
It stands today.
El Brindell came out of the vaudeville circuit before the First World War. He began as a German dialect comedian, doing routines about how difficult it was and how funny immigrants were. But, you know, back then it was European immigrants. And the humor was around. But when World War I came along, he realized that Germans weren't funny, so he had to become Swedish. So he changed his act to become a Swede and gets a sort of a 20, 30 year career out of it. In fact, as late as the 60s, he's still around doing guest spots on TV, and I think he had a few commercials. And so, but he's in Wings as a comedy mechanic. Mm-hmm. He's in
Big Trail.
Big Trail.
You guys know these pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Great movies.
So he's a bankable star.
Yeah.
From about 1929, 30. You know, when the talkies come in, there's suddenly a space on the big screen for people who are using dialogue and as humor. But they have to take it from the theater milieu at that time, where you've got somebody like Brindell, but he doesn't survive that long into the sound era. Other forms of verbal humor take over, I guess the Marx Brothers being the most successful.
Well, the big question is, does anyone else know the one other big role of Joy Zell?
Come on, the
Queen of Mars. Because she did another role in another giant movie. But that's the only place she turns up. Nobody knows it?
Queen of Mars?
Yeah. Yes. In the Sign of the Cross. The Sign of the Cross, she plays do you know the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you describe her role? She plays sort of a lesbian seductress and does a dance. I guess she's an exotic dancer.
Yeah.
But it's not dissimilar. It's Sign of the Cross is a great picture, by the way. I've often thought of showing it. It's one of the DeMille kind of sex and sand epics, and she tries to seduce the Christian girl. Doesn't get anywhere.
If you take this as a science fiction film, it's interesting to see that you've got two elements coming in. You've got the visual element coming in from the designers, most obviously Hugh Ferris, I think, who inspired Poussin's. And then you've got the literary science fiction genre, particularly the idea of a person falling asleep, or in this case dying, and being revived in the future. And that had been a very successful novel by Edward Bellamy, Looking Backward, which had come out in the 19th century, in the late 19th century, that William Morris did News from Nowhere. H.G. Wells did a novel called Sleep Awakes. And then this idea comes back later on in the century with Woody Allen's Sleeper, Idiocracy, the Mike Judge movie a few years ago, and which one am I forgetting?
The Mel Gibson movie.
Mel Gibson.
Forever Young.
Skip that one.
I don't think the system is that idea is a Imagine. If we're looking for an influence of Just Imagine, it's very hard to see it. What you see is that the things that inspired Just Imagine inspire people down the line. The themes discussed in Just Imagine crop up later on. Like, there are even some specific design things, like the idea of having guns that are sort of shaped like those staplers that they had in the 1990s.
Well, it's more direct than that, though. Those guns were literally used in the Flash Gordon series.
And the
spaceship was literally used, the same props. But this is a good segue. You know, we have this other reel which actually talks about exactly this, the influence of these movies. And what's interesting to me is that the next big one after this is Things to Come, which is super classy, and really does a deco future.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's similar to this kind of goofball movie.
But that's, you know, Things to Come has its own origin in the UK,
right?
And in a partnership between British filmmakers like with Corder and H.G. Wells itself. So it's sort of part of a pretense of British filmmaking, and I think has a different angle to it,
right.
to this film, which is sort of angled as entertainment in the first instance.
Yeah, yeah.
And any resemblance between this film and the genuine year 1980 is purely coincidental. Though actually, I do remember a lot of very very pointed collars and people taking pills.
I think you're thinking of Goodfellas. Those are the kind of shirts because they like those shirts. And of course
the costumes of the movie though did not keep up with the sets.
They weren't
futuristic at all.
The other thing that's a comment on 1930 is the fixation with the idea of aviation, and that you can really see the presence of Lindbergh in the film, sort of the shadow of Lindbergh, the idea that you have to do something in aviation to really prove yourself, that by 1980 everything in terrestrial aviation would have been accomplished, and somehow humanity's destiny is in the air, that cars will be replaced by airplanes. And this is something that remains as an idea in 1930s science fiction. So you have novels like, there's a novel called The Aerodrome, came out of Britain by, I'm spacing out on the guy's name, it's the idea in which airmen take over the government of Britain, and there's a little bit of that element within Things to Come, where the ideal future civilization is saved by airmen who are able to unite the world, wings over the world, and so in a way that same idea is kicking around in Just Imagine.
Well, shall we take a look at this? Because I think it's very interesting. You wind up seeing all these. This reel is not in chronological order, by the way. We try to order it so that more with a sense of sort of the motifs that are common in all these futuristic films. Are you ready to run, Dennis? Can we either go ahead? Yeah. Shall we?
Yes,
we should get two films on the reel.
Yeah, we'll have it.
Oh, great. Who's that? Is that Eric?
Winner.
I can't see. Who guessed it? Well, that's right. Dale Hennessy designed Sleeper, and he also designed Logan's Run.
I thought actually Logan's Run, of those clips, that was the one where I thought, let's see that on the big screen.
Really?
Well, I hadn't seen the other side, I remember on the big screen, but that one I've only ever seen on television, and just from those clips, you can see that there's more to it.
The reason why I
bought also Jenny Agutter in that costume.
Well,
that was something.
If you want to see Jenny Agutter, you've got to see Walkabout.
Yeah.
But still, the point of this really was to show what was interesting about these was how alike they were and in some ways how different they were. Now, Logan's Run, for instance, was clearly inspired by one of the World's Pharaohs we were having before the 70s. The whole look of the classic dolls, very much like the General Motors, which actually have some. Buckminster Fuller.
And in fact, World's Fairs is the medium by which a lot of these ideas are transmitted. And the architecture ideas that we see inspiring Just Imagine are brought forward in 1939 in the New York World's Fair, which has the theme of building a world of tomorrow. And a lot of the designers and 70s have formative experiences viewing the World's Fair in 39, and then these come back in, was it 64? Was it
a New York World's Fair, 63, 64, yeah.
A lot of the same themes. The General Motors Pavilion particularly recycles these themes, and these become almost like a vocabulary of the future that can then be referred to. And certainly other World's Fairs with the domes, with the monorails, they become these sort of futuristic spaces for showcasing your country as being the way of the future. So during the Cold War, a lot of the international rivalry is based around who has the best idea of the future, whose future is going to be better, the Soviet future or the American future. So there's a political edge to this side of things too. But I don't think you can really think about this subject without looking at the World's Fairs as well. It isn't a conversation that happens purely in the medium of movies. It's also in the exhibition space and other graphic design forms too.
Now, what's interesting about that, though, is the whole point of World's Fair really is to look toward the future. And the World's Fairs are always sort of happy. They look toward utopia. And what's interesting about all of these Hollywood movies, to me, is, and I wasn't trying to make this point one way or the other, they're mostly dystopias, right? And, I mean, you have the sort of perspective on this that the rest of us don't. I mean, do you think there's a reason why these movies have always tended to be so, such unpleasant futures for us?
I think that's to do with a dramatic medium. But if you want to tell a story, who wants to tell a story about somewhere where everything's perfect? Focus on the fly in the ointment. The great utopia in our popular culture is the Earth in Star Trek that you never actually see. They have to go out into space to find something to, a place in need of improvement, because they've already overcome violence and poverty and so forth. Maybe they don't have whales anymore, but everything else is
and actually, the classic novel to be adapted, which has been adapted twice, but not well either time, was Brave New World.
Yes.
I think it's been adapted for television twice.
Isn't there going to be a new Brave New World? Isn't it?
But it certainly fits what you're talking about, Paradise.
Somebody's got one in the works, I think. Might even be Ridley Scott's planning a Brave New World. Did anybody hear about this?
Unfortunately.
I don't know about that.
Dennis, we should look at some stills. Dennis, are you ready up there? Could we see number 15, say? No, number 15. So what futuristic city movie was made in the 50s? Where's the futuristic city in Forbidden Planet? Oh, the crew. Well, that was really the point, was that our film tonight was an outlier, you know? And there's not another film made like it until things to come, and then nothing like that until, I don't even know, it was the first. What would have been the first city that was in that sort of genre of these futuristic cities after things to come?
How about Buck Rogers? Yeah, cereal.
Well, sure. You know what that city was? You saw it tonight.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know it was inspired.
No, it was the same city.
Outtakes. Clips, yeah.
They used the same sets?
Yes.
No, yeah. Not the same sets, the same shots.
The same shots.
What about the Kane's war room there?
I don't know.
The shot where the ship comes into land. That was exerted and used in Buck Rogers. The spaceship model was used in Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
They really pillaged Just Imagine for stock shots of the future. And tiny clips and outtakes and reuse of the models, reuse of the interiors, and it's much more part of our visual memory than we realize. It's a very strange fate for a film. Have we got to some of the Antonio Sandalia pictures?
Yeah, we can go to that.
021, 22, 23, these amazing images from an Italian futurist architectural designer, and a lot of the I think very influential. Even though he died in the First World War.
Yeah, this is long. Yeah, this is very, very long ago that he was doing this kind of stuff. It looks very contemporary. I mean, we all love Mobius, but this is like 1911. Yeah. Sanelio, which is interesting, but why don't we look at the number 26, which is the guy that was most directly. This is the Hugh Ferris guy that.
He was commissioned by Harvey Wiley Corbett, the New York architect, during the 1920s to create an anthology of futuristic cityscapes, and he does a book called The Future Metropolis. It comes out maybe 1927. And that is an obvious reference point for the designs in Just Imagine.
And to me, I always think of this when I think of the movie Fountainhead.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of buildings that are done in there. This is our sense when they did Fountainhead of what these buildings should look like. Should we go to the next one?
And you got this massive tunnel that appears in Just Imagine, tunnels through skyscrapers.
Yeah. Go ahead to the next one. Go ahead. Go ahead. I think this guy's amazing. These are all done in chalk, right? So they probably don't even survive.
Did he have a lot of influence in Just Imagine?
Yeah, I think this is what they used as a crib sheet, really.
Right. Go to the next one. Might as well look at all of these. It's a bridge that's turned into a city. Very Just Imagine. And the next one. Now let's go to 37. There's a guy that comes before any of this stuff. Oh, this is Frank R. Paul. He's a cover artist that did a lot of this kind of stuff. Actually, the next one is even more. See, this goes back. This is 1911 that this drawing was done. So this is 20 years before a guy named Rommel. I don't know who he is at all. The next one is Rommel as well. Looks familiar? And this is 1910. And the next one at 39, I don't know if it's the same artist, but sort of a cartoon version. Where should we go now? What would you like to show?
Well, should we go towards the end and look at some of the cover of the Ferris book is 67.
67, Dennis, please.
And then I think there's one from the World's Fair, 68. Oh, that's a Russian one.
Yeah, that's 41. I think he's going in order for some reason. Can we go to 67, Dennis, please? This is incredibly interesting.
That's the Hammerus.
Yeah. Hammerus patented the glass shot, which I don't know what the Brits think about that. Because they were doing, but
yeah, this
that blew my mind. This is the cover of the Hugh Ferris book.
And then the next one would be the GM from 64.
What is it?
GM 68.
The next one, please, Dennis, 68. Yeah, it's like a 60s version of the city.
What year was that? 64, 63, 64.
That's sort of an interesting city. All the main structure.
But in a way, the whole concept of, maybe we should go back to and how do we look at the stills that were produced around Just Imagine, number two, and so forth?
Sure.
It might be worth going back to those. I mean, part of what's interesting is the very fact that in the 20s, they're imagining the future as urban. It was only during that decade that the majority of Americans had lived in cities for the first time.
Mm.
America really had been a majority rural country up to that point, so it's part of the coming to terms with the reality of America's future. And today, as we think about, by 2020, the least urban continent, which is Africa, will have a majority urban population. So you know, the future of humanity is in cities, is in the urban environment. I find that just mind-boggling that even Africa will be a majority city.
But this is a particular kind of city that really doesn't exist anywhere.
Yeah.
Manhattan is a particular thing that
there's an assumption that Manhattan is going to be the leading city, the showpiece of opportunity. Look at the light bulbs in that. There are over 10,000 light bulbs were used in the set.
Mm-hmm.
So no wonder they needed so many people to screw them in and maintain them. The next one's terrific too. High angle shot.
Doesn't show up in the movie though.
No, and
it's so typical.
I mean, the whole business about canals with ocean liners in—I don't recall seeing that.
Yeah.
In the final film.
Today. A lot of this borrowed from Europe. A lot of those look like steeples, like the. You know,
mm-hmm.
So they're all kind of
mm-hmm.
like the churches and that.
Yeah, it's Gothic, isn't it? It's got a sort of you've got Gothic spires up on the things. Especially the bridge ends.
Well, you know, you have to wonder, geologically, you know, New York is just one big rock.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you could have a city like New York anywhere else. You know, the kind of buildings that high, so many of them.
Yeah.
You know,
Hong Kong.
Is it made out of rock?
Yeah,
Hong Kong would be the one other example.
And thinking of, you know, as you go around the world, sometimes you see cities that make you think of the cities that are represented in these movies. I'm just back from Seoul.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly made me think of Blade Runner, with giant video screens playing weird videos in the middle of the night, and sort of skyscrapers going so high, and a sense of being alienated, just as a
stranger to that whole place.
Yeah, yeah, for real.
It seems that the and did you see the lawsuit that came out a couple of years ago now in Los Angeles over whether or not it was appropriate to have giant animated billboards?
Yeah.
And in defense, the company that wanted to erect these said, this is part of our future. Look at the Blade Runner. The fact that this has been represented in a dystopian film gave them a right to bring it into existence, you know? What next? You know, they want to have psychopathic cyborgs just because they're in Terminator. Actually don't encourage people because they think they're some of the arms manufacturers.
They're the majority now. You see those billboards everywhere. All of them turned into that neon.
Yeah.
Does anyone else?
Did you spot the advertisement for Pan Am? I've forgotten that was in Blade Runner because it's in 2001 that they're referencing Pan Am. And it's sort of ironic that Pan Am doesn't make it into that far into the 90s.
Yeah.
But we imagine it it's going to be part of our future. Mm-hmm. Isn't it?
Does anyone else have any questions? there's a person here. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, this is so much fun to play. But what is so amazing to me is the similarities. How this architecture goes all the way back to different continents,
yeah,
different centuries, and how similar it is. I mean, you know, the Aztec, the Greeks, the Roman cities, we're talking about metropolitan areas. And I've been to Chaco Canyon and those flip dwellings, you know, with circular buildings. There's some buildings in Chaco Canyon that are so space age, so futuristic looking. And those people couldn't even draw, you know. And that is what's so fascinating to me. And it goes back to, well, if you take the Greek cities and you study the Greek philosophers, those handy sayings, we're saying this, I mean, they apply through all these centuries, you know. Then we add on to things, but basically, and these Tibetan temples and things like that, I mean, they look futuristic. I mean, it's just amazing how there is this similarity in all these different parts.
I think sometimes it's interesting to see how natural forms that can be reflected, like the idea of a beehive or the termite mound, and sort of shapes from nature crop up in these sort of cultural gardens. But sometimes people seem to be borrowing from each other, other times great minds think alike, and so both things are going on. But you're right to point to that.
Well, when you look at science fiction movies, they're usually plundering, you know, the Lucas movies are plundering, you know, Inca temples and
sure,
that kind of stuff. You even see
And the city planet Coruscant in the later three Star Wars films, mm-hmm, obviously reflecting or an homage to this particular tradition of rendering the city.
Mm-hmm. This is all actually my stuff, but I think I've been collecting books my whole life. You can't be a movie art director without weighing up your whole down your whole house with books. But hey, none of this stuff is, you know, proprietary. This
first quick question. So it's projecting the future, which comes out in October, September, October.
Yeah, October 15th.
Okay.
And the publisher is Andy Torres, which is over here. It's published by Paul Gray. But if you've just Googled...
It's on Amazon right now, you said.
Yeah, if you just Google Cull, which is the same thing the Canadians do to baby seals, that's how you'll get to the book.
The other question was, I noticed they were talking about aircraft, and I know that before World War II ended, that Henry Ford was an anti-Semite.
Yes.
And if I was picking that joke up right, they were Jewish-named aircraft.
Yes.
Fords don't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Was that the...
Yeah, it was absolutely an in-joke at the expense of Henry Ford, who had used his the newspaper he controlled, the Dearborn Patriot, I think, had run some
virulently anti-Semitic articles in the 1920s, and this has been a subject of public controversy. So for all the aircraft, the vehicles of the next generation to have Jewish names was something that Single O could remark on. I think somebody's getting their own back on Henry Ford. And it's a wonderful
thing. It's kind of amazing that they would take a shot like that, yeah.
It needs a footnote in, where are we now, 2012.
After World War II, I believe that he apologized for, and he came to amends for the stuff he did.
Think that? I think of a certain way of lighting sets. I don't think of this architecture as being, this is deco architecture. You know, I don't think this is a German expressionist film at all.
I definitely could see the way the shadows and everything are. Right. And also, even if it's deco, they're still connected. I think the German expressionism was really strong with Metropolis, and I can see German expressionism in this right here.
Oh, we just disagree about that. You think this connects to the Cabinet of Caligari? The Cabinet of Caligari, which is considered the German expressionist film of all. Just another person.
Yeah, I mean, because that, because you should be talking to the laboratory, because that is the first showing of things that then turn up in the Frankenstein.
There's a guy named Ken Strickfaden, who is, I'm sure you guys have heard of him, who has always been credited with the machines in Frankenstein. And I looked at it very carefully. I don't know, but they say that this was indeed the same electrical machinery that show off stuff in the laboratory. I think it's interesting to compare this laboratory. I think it's interesting to compare this laboratory to the laboratory in Metropolis, because that's a more direct comparison. And they're very different. I don't know which one I like better, but I was surprised when the first time in this movie, because that set in particular has a real solidity and a real, you know, it has something to it. Not that chair's not so good, but.
But it's interesting that the way in which the scientist is represented.
Right.
As
the
offhand way in which you bring somebody to life after 50 years and it's now we're done with you. It shows us. It's making fun of the ambivalence around the ambivalence of the scientist, the moral ambivalence.
Well, it's worse than that. He offers to kill the guy. Do you think that's
the moment that I saw the things that you showed later on, which I thought was brilliant about this, was that Sleeper, Woody Allen kind of approached it, but this had the comedic approach, the comedy and the whole energy, and also the theatrical, the musical comedy. And I haven't seen that many.
That's a good question for the audience, actually. Is this the only science fiction musical?
Dr. Marvel?
Well, Spaceballs isn't really it has a musical sequence, but.
There's one in
1933
called It's Great to Be Alive.
It's Great to Be Alive.
Wait a minute. She mentioned Bollywood. There was a Bollywood movie called Robot, which I know very well. In Robot?
No. In Bollywood musicals in general, it has that same, thwarted, the arranged marriage versus... Yeah.
But you were asking for a science fiction musical, and I think I can tell you this one. It's this Indian picture called Robot. It's kind of a Jekyll and Hyde movie.
But I think if I say this, nobody else has attempted a science fiction musical. Within the American context, it hasn't...
Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. Comic book, but there are science fiction elements to it.
It's a blog.
Yeah. It's an online movie, about 45 minutes long. You can get it up as a Blu-ray.
No studio has.
I think we're asking about movies. How about the movie I mentioned, which probably no one else has seen. Well, Rocky Horror is a good example, actually. Or the Apple. Does anyone know the Apple? Terrible, right? Terrible. Golden and Globus, you know, probably shot in Israel or something. I don't know. I mean, really low ball sci-fi. But it's a musical with songs by, like, Menachem Golden wrote the songs. I mean, it's really interesting. You see it on a double. I saw it on a double bill at the Cinematheque with Xanadu, which is a fantasy musical, not a science fiction musical.
Is this a Rico genetic opera?
Oh, I've heard of that. Yeah. But Rocky Horror Picture Show is a pretty good choice. It's sort of.
It's the only one commercially successful.
Rocky.
The only one of the science fiction musicals.
And it took how many 20 years to be successful? In your book, you mentioned that they liked Butler because he had, in Sunnyside Up, he had brought in color and he'd done some things. But he doesn't seem to have shown much directorial flair in this at all.
No, he really seems to have phoned it in, just as if he was filming a...
But yeah, it seems like a silent film. Girls. the moment on the machinery in those arms.
Yeah.
Astonishing amount of work. And it winds up being, you know, it's a title sequence in the Flash Gordon serials.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was reduced to. Yeah, it's very transitional. I mean, the other day I turned on TCM and they were running Intolerance. You look at Intolerance, it's astonishingly sophisticated, you know? But all that was lost for a while, you know?
Did you notice a strong connection between the look of the Emerald City and Munchkin Land with the look of Mars and some of the...
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't notice it until now. I think you're right, though.
This is one of the issues that comes out. Was when people were reviewing this, they weren't sure what they were reviewing. Nobody said, oh, let's go along and see the latest science fiction picture. It was sold as a fantasy picture, and so the reviewers compare it not to other films they've seen about the future, like, for example, Metropolis, but the major comparison is to Thief of Baghdad as being a large-scale fantasy picture. And that's what comes up in the reviews. They don't know what they're looking at. And
science fiction as a genre didn't really exist.
No, this is the point. And looking forward, probably The Wizard of Oz is the most obvious comparison. And one of the questions is, why don't you get more movies like this? And there are questions over how much money this kind of film can make. And what I found looking at major science fiction films and looking at their budgets was that they weren't making a fantastic amount of money, but a lot of them weren't losing money either. They just weren't making a ton of money.
And it seemed
like a high-risk project. And the ones that get made become vanity projects. So this is
science fiction didn't really become the go-to moneymaker until Star Wars.
No. The starting gun is 2001. And once 2001 has happened, other people say, well, let's greenlight this kind of project. And Star Wars is greenlit on the back of 2001. And there's this SF boom during the 1970s where they decide, well, let's make Logan's Run, make it straight rather than as a comedy, as one of the plans in the 1960s. Logan's Run as a comedy. Yeah, there's a Rod Serling script for Logan's Run kicking around out there. And that took a long time to make, much longer than I might have thought.
But the Art Deco-ness of Wizard of Oz, which is 10 years after this, is almost at the end of that Art Deco entry in movies, because if you look at those clips you were showing of all those other, of the same designer, it's almost like Hollywood created this Art Deco architectural language that doesn't exist anywhere else but in these kind of giant movies, where the whole language of architecture is completely changed and these kind of almost like frou-frou elements are put on top of, pasted on onto things.
Mm-hmm.
And then you follow that progression through the 30s, and then once we get World War II, it's just vanished. It's just, there's no more Art Deco. It's fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's cool.
So what themes do you see here that are reflected in science fiction films of later eras?
Well, I think the relationship between the individual and their environment, the relationship between humans and technology, the scientist, the theme of twinning comes up a lot in science fiction. The Jekyll and Hyde type dynamic. The idea of gender relationships. The idea of hyper-feminine costumes seems to come back and back and back. And actually, one of the ways in which this film was marketed was in terms of, you will blush to see the fashions of 1980. Imagine the petting technique of people 50 years from now. And so they marketed this film around the exoticism and eroticism of the future. And I think if you came to see this film hoping for a sort of titillation, you might well go away disappointed. So maybe they used the wrong repetitiveness of some of the songs, and so the Martian dance was cut out in a lot of cities. The song Never Swat a Fly was cut out, and other elements were cut out, so that in some cities people were seeing a butchered version of this, which ran a lot shorter. They were very uncomfortable, the whole joke about Give Me the Good Old Days, which was the biggest laugh when this film was shown originally, and a lot of reviewers commented on that. That didn't play in any city because it was thought too sexual. Yes. Yes, yes, I think they didn't really, they just threw everything they had into it, and I don't think it was particularly planned through. They just thought, what would be funny to...
Well, they were singing about flies screwing and stuff, and they were implying that they screwed like flies, so that doesn't necessarily yield you babies, but it's still eroticism, isn't it?
Well, I might be dropping the spot, kid.
Yeah.
But let's pass for the actual review.
It was passed nationally, but then censored locally, and so it ran into problems in particular locations around the country.
Did you have a question?
I just want to mention, since it's been brought up a couple times, Wilkins Run, it's been restored. They're showing it at the Cinerama Dome.
Oh, great!
September 8th.
Are they showing it anywhere else in the dome?
Just that kind of sort of dome.
We're screening town.
Things to come is supposed to be based on glass, and terms of construction methods. But, you know, I think you're making a good point. The chap behind you.
I just wanted to say this period of skyscraper building in New York, where they're building the cathedrals of commerce, so to speak, that Hugh Ferris illustrated, and Raymond Hood and so forth, that were active, it's all was affected by the setback law, zoning requirements that the buildings as they went up had to have a certain amount of base area, and you had to step the building up back. You couldn't build a slab like the Pan Am building that occurred after the war. And the look of all this period, which is what they projected from, is affected by that. Because as you go up, you keep going back more like a cathedral in Europe. And it gave a very specific look for that one for a period from the 20s until about the war.
Right.
And after the war, new technologies and a whole new approach changed that look. So this is a very narrow period that they're extending these steps from. Quite a bit different than the European modernist or the streamlined modern or any of the international style, which were quite a bit different. But these are always lit from underneath, the Hugh Ferris drawings included. So they had this wonderful, they look great at night, because the glow of the city goes up and the shadows are going up on the building instead of coming down. But a lot of the shots in the movie that we saw are daylight shots. Mm-hmm. And they lose some of that magic of the glow from underneath.
Mm-hmm. One thing you know you have to understand about the Hugh Ferris drawings, in a way, these are advertising drawings. They're designed to be incredibly good-looking things. They're not really supposed to be about engineering or science. They're supposed to look fabulous. You know, he was selling things, right?
Well, I just think also that, exactly to your point, that that was a long setback law. And the idea is, and this is why I think that it's really Manhattan as the future, because when you look at all these, and almost all of these shots of future cities in these movies are aerial shots. You rarely see them going through the tunnels, going off at the street. There's no streetscape almost at all. And they're all heroic, you know, ideas. And they're not about city planning. They're about the city gorges, you know. So they're not about how you get in, how you get out, about the problems. And that doesn't happen later to Blade Runner. And those kind of, but they're almost all about piling on and piling on. And even if you look at that 1911 thing, they basically took elements of Manhattan at the time, almost like a cut and paste, and just kept pasting and cutting them on top of each other, the way the city was kind of evolving at the time. But I think it's really interesting because it's so imprinted on us about what a future city is. Unlike something like Silent Running, which was a concept. You know, most of these buildings, most of these are based on that Manhattan concept, not on a real utopia, not on a real place where you get light. I think the other one that's really good is Brazil, when they're driving through the outer parts of the city, and you're finally at street level. That's one of the few times in a science fiction movie that you're really seeing, you know, the city go by.
That's a very interesting point, because lately I'm hearing people talk about the Manhattan as being an ideal city, not because of skyscrapers, but because when they planned it, they had more parks. Mm-hmm. And there's very little landscape included in any of these futuristic cities. You know?
Well, I mean,
that great draw.
They imagine, just imagine they had these ribbon parks, so they have parkways, which is kind of Olmsted's idea for Los Angeles, that we have parkways.
Which we're supposed to be building on the river.
Yeah,
actually.
That was, so this idea of bringing the park into the city, that's a very...
But in things to come, when you see those trees on those balconies, it's a wonderful setting of scale for the building.
Yeah.
When you see these big trees, what you imagine are big trees, and it's a really kind of fantastic idea that they did that.
The idea just imagine is that the city is underground, really.
Right.
And it's open to the air, and then the rest of it on the earth is a park. That's kind of the idea. Look, the earth would be unspoiled, I guess.
It's a little bit like Blade Runner, you know, where at the end of the movie you see that there's actually this bucolic paradise outside of the hellish city.
Don't say that around Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
That's an add-on. It's got nothing to do with the movie.
Yeah, it's the shots from Shining.
Is that what it's from?
Helicopter shots from the Shining.
Is it?
Yeah,
that had nothing to do with Blade Runner. Yeah. This guy.
Most of these images, like the one we're seeing now, they emphasize the vertical scale, and that tells everyone that it must be a fantasy, because
you heard of Dubai? They have a building in Dubai that looks doesn't look much shorter than that.
Well, they're getting better.
It's horrible, but. You see that?
Yeah.
Steps on a thing and go, hey, don't they have that? They don't have that in the bathroom yet.
My favorite thing like that is the design of the flipped phone. This obviously references the communicator in Star Trek, that people want to be able to do that. And that the images we've seen in popular culture